you hold space while people disintegrate and dysregulate and act out in, like, we see that Jesus on the cross, forgive them. They know not what they do. They are literally having collective amygdala hijack. This is mob mentality. They truly physiologically, I'm not justifying the murder of Jesus, but I am saying they, from a neurobiological state, they lost their compassion, their ability to access compassion and to see Jesus as a human. Hence the violence that we perpetuate when we dehumanize people.
He held the space inside of.
He held that, grace, that, right? That like it wasn't unmerited favor for the mob. Mm-hmm. It was, he recognized what state they're in. Like, oh, this is an amygdala hijack.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I had the pleasure of meeting a truly compelling voice at the intersection of mysticism, neuroscience, scholarship, and theology, Reverend and Dr. Shalene Kendrick. Shalene Kendrick is a mystic, scholar, and minister to human evolution. She's the creator of the neuro-relational integration model, the neuro-spirituality of wholeness-making through mind-body-spirit integration. With a doctorate in theology specializing in neurotheology, she helps people bridge the gap between ancient spiritual wisdom and contemporary neuroscience, translating complex research into practical daily tools for conscious evolution. Her work reveals how integration across three neural centers, mind, IQ, body, SQ, spirit, RQ, generates emergent properties and transforms reactive patterns into responsive wisdom. Shalene's mission centers on facilitating human evolution in practice, moving from fragmentation to coherence, from survival to flourishing. More information about Shalene in the website www.nrintegration.com. We've had a very rich, nourishing, inspiring conversation with Shalene, exploring the neurobiology of everything, of wholeness, the neurobiology of shame, the role of Jesus when seen through these particular lenses, the importance of evolution and how to understand evolution, this ongoing question of what does it mean to be human in the present times we are living, how to deal with the challenges of technology, AI, fragmentation, what's actual salvation as an ongoing journey, and so many other topics in between all that. So this is the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome again. To support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. And if you feel nourished, inspired by the conversation, feel free to share it, like it, drop your thoughts in the comment section to keep the conversation flowing. Without further ado, dear brothers and sisters, here is Dr. Shalene Kendrick. So welcome, Shalene. Thanks so much for joining us in our conversation. I've chosen to name the podcast Free Radical Podcast for different reasons. I have a book called Radical Personalism, but recently the term took a new life of its own. Free radical, for me, it's also radical, come from radix, going to the root. So how to go to the marrow of things in a way that is free radical, in a way that is freeing and liberating. So I trust that we'll be able to explore together the roots of things in a redeeming way.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And usually I start to start sharing how I get to know about my guests somehow or other. And in your case, we have never met in person yet, but a friend of mine, Bhakti Rasa, met you last year in a conference you were giving that was in Charlotte, I think.
Yeah, North Carolina.
Okay, yeah. So you were exposing there, presenting there, and she was basically blown away by your presentation, to be honest. And
she was amazing.
And then she shared with me your presentation and now then my mind was blown away correspondingly. And I think she shared with you my book when you met in person as well.
Yes, I have it I have
Let's
it
see
here
how
with
blown
me.
away you have been with that one. Let's see, that doesn't need to be a corresponding blowing away.
It is. It is corresponding. I love it. I can't. It's all highlighted up. My books are my friends, so you're my new best friend.
Thank you. So all that to say that from all that, the rest is history, and here we are talking today.
Yes.
And also, I like to ask my guests every time they come, like, what brings you today to this conversation? What brings you today to the table? Especially, I'm thinking about the Christian image of heaven, or like an abundant feast, like an abundant banquet.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think of these conversations as sitting at the table and enjoying a big feast together, like a trailer of eternity in that sense, so to say. In my
that.
Own tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, this is the very same thing we say. It's like when, like Jesus will say, when two or three get together, there I am. And like eternally nourishing each other, delighting and nourishing one another by engaging in any type of exchange. So I don't know, what brings you here today, Shalin?
Well, first the invite. Thank you so much. And I so enjoyed meeting your friend. She was amazing and such good conversations with her after. And so my life mission is to help people bridge the gap between neurobiology and theology. I didn't have language for it growing up, but growing up, I've always been a mystic in the sense that I would get like really visceral visions, awakenings, enlightenings. But growing up in my religious context, that was more akin to witchcraft, not allowed. And so I learned to fracture myself in a way, compartmentalize, you know, you split yourself into multiple people. And I've spent my entire adulthood I'm an integration seeker. So wholeness making has become my ultimate concern not that I love everything Tillich said, but I do really appreciate the idea of an ultimate concern. That which you're ultimately concerned with will drive and define and shape all other aspects of your life. And in my old religious context, I was ultimately concerned with salvation. However, salvation meant escape from the human experience, escape from the human body, escape from the earth to a perfect utopian posthumous state, whatever that may be.
An evacuation plan into the afterlife.
Yes.
Like
my whole life was lived for the afterlife. And I was missing my present life. My whole, I was both missing and hateful towards. And I just had so much anger growing up. And I couldn't quite figure out where that was coming from. And now, as a neurotheologian and entering the field of neurospirituality through the door of theology, not through neuroscience, I have so much more language now to go, oh, wow, all those beliefs about God were priming my amygdala. No wonder I was so angry. No wonder I saw the world as a place of war and myself as one of God's warriors. And so all that to say, to bring it back to the ultimate concern, I'm still ultimately concerned with salvation. And to talk through what I love so much about your book is how reality is in process, and to be alive is to change. And so although I'm still ultimately concerned with salvation, what salvation means has evolved, and to your point, radically both changed and set me free, where salvation is now wholeness making. And so where salvation used to be an escape from the human body and the human world and the human experience, salvation is now being and becoming made whole in and through the human experience, in and through the full body. So I've become that much more in love with who I am as a human, who my fellow humans are, and with this earth in a way that, man, when I was trying to escape it, there wasn't a whole lot of love there. So that is what brings me here, is I am deeply passionate about wholeness making and evolution, and how do we bridge the gap, and how do we experience the divine in our neurobiology rather than apart from. So that's where I'm starting.
Thank you. That's more than an ideal warming up.
Good.
And I really appreciate your, as part of your journey, what you mentioned about the, by entering to neurotheology, neurobiology, and connecting all these dots with spirituality, how you gain a new language to articulate what was missing. I have finished recently reading this book, maybe you know it, from Walter Brueggemann, The Prophetic Imagination.
Yeah, I've read it. I read it every year.
Okay.
Walter
this is my
Brueggemann
first reading, but I don't think that will be the last for sure.
You have to keep read every year I read it. The same with The Way of the Heart, and I just keep finding something new every time.
Yeah.
It's a new book every time I read it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I feel. I feel, okay, I'm reading it, but I'm quite sure this won't be the last time I'm reading it. There's thick with layers of content and meaning. And he emphasized so much the importance of articulation and having a language to not only articulate, but even imagine a certain reality that if you don't cannot even articulate in your imagination what real salvation means, you cannot move further than that, beyond it. So I really appreciate that in your journey. Sorry, you want to say something?
Well, I was thinking this back to neurobiology. If you can imagine it, you can become it. And the way that the human consciousness and mind works is that without imagination, you actually can't, if you can't imagine it, you cannot move towards it, nor can you move into it. And so there is, to his point, prophetic imagination is a way that helps us be and become more fully human, because we can now imagine what a more full version of ourselves would look like.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that's so much to the point of the current times we are living. He will make the point, and this book was written half a century ago, interestingly, but very prophetic, going to his name.
Yes, seriously.
He'll say that in the modern times we are living, we are very expert at implementing almost everything, but at imagining almost nothing. So before implementation, there has to be imagination. And that applies to religious groups and everything and everyone. Our modern times, implementing, but not much creative, prophetic, visionary capacity to see, to imagine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, I think a lot of my work, a lot of my dissertation sits around the mechanistic age and mechanistic thinking, which is implementation. And when we get so deep into mechanistic thinking, we actually do lose access to the more creative parts of who we are and how our minds function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's all tied to who we are as humans and our potential as humans. And we will go there in a minute, in an age of AI and how to keep our humanity and our potential in place.
Yes.
And going for a moment back to Walter Brueggemann's book, actually, and again, hopefully it doesn't sound too self-referential, that can end in being too self-reverential, but in many ways I was reading his book and I could relate to what I was trying to do in my recent book that you've been reading, at least from the perspective of my own tradition, trying to articulate certain things with certain language, trying to imagine a certain horizon of potential that if we don't even try to speak about it and try to find words, it's not existing, basically. Right. So again, you've shared, you have appreciated my book. I'm very humbled by that. I can imagine why many reasons, knowing about your work and also since what I've heard from you so far, I mean, I can see we share so many, not only paradigms, we share so many wonderful common friends and elders like Ilia Delio or Father Richard Rohr or Thomas J. Ord.
Yes, Dr. Delio. Well, I got to study with and under Thomas J. Ord as open and relational theology. And then Dr. Delio was on my dissertation defense committee. Mm-hmm. And I felt like a fangirl the whole time. I had such a hard time defending my research because I was just like, I'm just so happy to be talking to you. It was there's not many people I fangirl over. She is one of them.
Mm. Yeah, I had the chance of meeting her in person last year in DC. It was beautiful. So anyhow, going to my book and the episode, and recently by the time our episode will be published, our conversation a few days after, there will be an online open and relational theology conference, and all of you listeners are more than invited to participate.
Please come. I said, please come. Come join us.
Please. And among other works and authors, I've been invited by Thomas to introduce my book, and I receive input and questions from, among other people, I think you as well, right?
Yep. I actually just got, he asked me to, I had switched me to a neuroscience panel and I was so sad because I kept saying, but I really love his book. And then he goes, well, you get to be on a podcast with him. I was like, okay, I'm going to nerd out on my podcast here with you. And then I have to switch to the neuroscience one, which I'm very also excited about.
And now we are having a trailer of all that will not be able to happen in the conference now as well.
Exactly.
So I'm curious about what inspired you most from my book. Again, not want to sound narcissistic, but just because I always gain insight from other people reading my material, and the book keeps expanding by the perspectives of other people. So anything that comes to your mind, like immediately.
Well, the two things that unite us more than anything, and that has been so deeply powerful to me, is asking that question, what does it mean to be human? And we're at, I mean, humans have asked this question clearly since the beginning of time in humanoids. However, especially given our historical moment in time, it is exceptionally hard to be human right now. And I see when I read your work, and your book kept expanding what it means to be human and giving language for what it means to be human. And then to the other part of open and relational, the aspect of relationality, you did an amazing job of locating spirituality inside both our neurobiology and our evolutionary process. And there's very few people doing that. And so that's what brought me into your work to go, oh my gosh, we are seeing the world through a similar prism, totally different cultural traditions, religious traditions. And also, so much of what you say and the way you say it makes my heart sing. And I just felt such a kinship with you, such a deep connection of human siblings asking similar questions with very little else in common. And I think that to me is the key to being human today, is to find, where do you see that which is God, the divine is what, I love my friend Tammy says, that which is God, and I love that. And so I just see so much of, we're asking very similar questions and we're interested in very similar things, and yet we have very little in common. And I think that is such a gift to humankind to be able to cross that bridge. And that's one of the things I've loved about, I don't want to say, I didn't leave my earlier tradition. I'm really working on integrating my childhood and my early adulthood into my present life. However, with that said, my earlier self would have felt very threatened. I would have seen you as an enemy. And so it has become such a deep joy to read your book and to see you as a friend and to have a deep desire for friendship and that word kinship. And so that's what unites me, is that you're asking huge, brilliant questions, but you're doing it in a way that is practical, easy to access, easy to understand, and allows me, it's funny you say that about Walter Brueggemann's book. I feel the same about yours. I could read it every year and find something new in it. So you've done a really brilliant job of layering in depth with accessibility, and that's a gift. So I've loved it.
Thank you. Deep gratitude, and thanks for such an endorsement. In my second updated edition of the book, I included. But yeah, thank you. And I appreciate what you mentioned, how that, okay, after reading the book, you've wanted, okay, I want to be friends with this person. And that's a great way of justifying why I write books, to discover new friends and hopefully to make the other person feel, okay, you have a new friend in me. Because at the end of the day, I'm not writing books to earn a living, to make a bestseller and whatever. It's just about... In our tradition in Sanskrit, we'll say Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, which means the whole world is one family. So to increase my awareness of that fact, because of course it's an easy one-liner, but a difficult one-walker, so to say, to walk that line.
Well, and that's exactly right what the historical Jesus meant by love your enemies. He's also saying the whole world is one family. Your enemy is your brother, your sister, your cousin. They are related to you.
Yeah.
And
we are all one human family. Totally. That's how I like to say it. Like, if everything is interrelated with the divine, then we're all relatives, basically. I mean, I'm not limiting that to the human species, but everything is relative.
Everything.
And sometimes you say relative to something, so it's missing connection to something.
Yes.
From there we have the word also, we are relatives, right? We are in relation to the other, but to another.
I was studying, I don't know if you've read The Aramaic Jesus yet. It is by Neil Douglas Coltz, and he talks about in it that in the Aramaic language, there is the ba sound that means both within and among at the same time. And I just, most of my, you know, my early childhood, early adulthood of reading Jesus, it was reading Jesus in the way that my religious beliefs were about separating. Everything was a separation between me and God, me and you, me and the world. And then when I reread it with Aramaic, I go, wait, this is within and among. This is, to your point, a relation, interrelating. Everything is interrelated. And it's, I loved your leading question, by the way, living life from the inside out. How willing are you? And I would say I was not all that willing about 20 years ago. And now this version of me, that's all I want, is to actively listen and silent contemplation. I love that you talked about the presence of the divine and all I see. And I love that you say you don't see. And that is that Aramaic ba, within and among. I'm so insatiably curious about what all the connected relationships are.
You are very capable of bringing so much content in a few sentences. I really appreciate that.
I'm a fast talker. This is where my neurodiverse ADD brain serves me fast, well.
One thing is to talk fast, another thing is to talk fast plus deep, thick content. So I really appreciate that.
I will continue to try to slow down, y'all.
Yeah. You keep throwing at me thought-provoking bombs. So really, it's beautiful. It's not an attack at all. It's a gift. One gift.
Thank you. I received that.
Thank you.
It's the gift of the web brain. I spent a long time being so sad about my ADHD brain until I learned about the evolution of ADHD brains and where they sit in evolutionary history. And I've never been more glad or proud to have a web-like, I think in schema, like I am disabled in the sense that I am not able to think in a line, to talk in a line, to read in a line, to walk in a line.
Who says that reality operates in a line, right?
Yes. And we need line thinkers. Like, we definitely need neurotypical brains, people who can, like, you know, stay focused on a goal and get there. And also, we need people like me now more than ever that are making all the connections and have these web-like brains that are saying we cannot stay siloed out and mechanistic any longer. We will not survive. And so it's been a gift to... Every sentence says five things for me.
And I can really identify with that as well without comparing myself fully with you, but I can really see myself in the... I like to say that sometimes I do weekly Q&As and people ask me a question, and I call them Q&A, not Q&A, I call it quest and exploration rather than question and answer. I don't like to sound I'm giving you the answer. And sometimes the question is very light, direct, but the exploration is an exploration, right? It's not just this is the answer. Yes. And I joke saying in my Chinese horoscope and monkey, so I'm just jumping from one branch to the other, but hopefully in the same tree, so to say, in the context of, okay, we're exploring one same reality, but we can go here and there. And in that connection, I want to ask you something, because you mentioned something, and let me go for a minute to this first lecture that Bhakti Rasa went and she recommended to me, because you said a lot of interesting stuff there, and those who are interested in watching it, you please, we will add the link there. But there you start, going back to where we are now in this era, you speak about the post-modern era, where everything is interconnected, and the science proved that, and also mystical traditions have revealed that for a long time. Many times the science catch up with the mystics in one way, and that's great.
Yes.
It's a beautiful complementary work. And you mentioned that, therefore, to be relevant in the times we are living means to be multidisciplinary. Speaking about, again, one sentence having five meanings and going all over the place in the good sense of the term. So to be multidisciplinary, to be integrative, and last but not least, as you mentioned this word a few times already, to be curious about everything.
Everything.
To be obsessed with reality, if you will. So let's begin there for a moment with the crucial importance of integration and curiosity to navigate our current times, if you want to share some thoughts about it.
Yeah, I would love to. So how familiar are you with the term evolutionary mismatch? Have you heard that yet?
I've heard that from you, and I was going there in a few minutes, but
Okay.
you can go there now, no
I'll
problem.
start with that because
Yeah.
it to me it's been one of the things. If you so I'm similar to you, I travel a lot and I'm in many, many, many conversations. And the thing that I'm hearing over and over and over again, the two themes, the first one we spoke about, people really asking what does it mean to be human right now? Because for the first time ever, not only are we facing the collapse of the human species, but to Ilya Delio's point, there might not, the machines might actually take over and there might not actually be human beings any longer. So wondering what does it mean to be human is especially a crucial question to wrestle with right now. Along with that is welcome to the super cycle, friends. If you have not yet heard, Amy Webb is a futurist. The South by Southwest 2024. It's a if you just Google that, Amy Webb, it's probably the best TED talk of how to explain our times in 15 minutes.
What's the
And
title
so she
again?
does,
Sorry.
it's Amy Webb, it's the South by Southwest, and it's a conference of technology, all different futurists get together. And she does a brilliant job in her that specific talk of talking about the super cycle and what makes our moment in history especially unique and especially challenging. She talks about the super cycle, meaning it's the convergence of three very particular inventions that all happened at the same time. So it's the idea that there's AI along with data collection. So think about, you know, your Apple watches, your Halo rings, that we have these huge databases now that we can collect all human information and then synthesize them together. And also the marriage of our technology with our biology. So any one of those inventions would radically change how humans live. The convergence of all three at the same time, she brilliantly likened it to, can you imagine if the plow, the steam engine, and the microchip were all created in the same decade? Anyone, the plow changed the way humans live, right? The agricultural age, we moved into cities with just one invention. And then the steam engine changed how interconnected we are. And then cue the microchip and it's that. So if all three of those happened at the same time, can you imagine how fast our both our technology and our like the way we live would change?
Speaking about imagination, right? Can you imagine?
Yes.
We
Can
need
you
to imagine.
imagine? Yes. So I want you to imagine being in the agricultural era, and all of a sudden you have the plow, the steam engine, and the microchip, but you're still farming. Right, you're still like trying to live agriculturally, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna get on a steamboat and check my iPad at the same time. So these convergence of technologies are touching and changing every aspect of human life across the globe. So that is creating basically the easier way to say it is our technology has evolved and outpaced what our human neurobiology is able to manage and to keep pace with. So there's a gap between our neurobiology and our technology and our societal structures, the way we live.
That's what you refer to by an evolutionary mismatch.
Yes. So we are mismatched. It's always been hard to be human. So don't get me wrong about that. It's especially hard during evolutionary mismatch. Maybe the best, my most favorite imagination of this is the polar bears. Okay. Who knows that the polar bears are currently evolving? Only a certain sect of them, though. It's so fascinating. So, with the climate change, we're facing the extinction of polar bears because there's now they're not able to live in both sea and ice conditions. However, in Greenland, there's a small, tiny group of polar bears that ended up on what scientists call climate refugia. And because of this isolated inlet, because they're not with the other polar bears, this one group of polar bears started changing their behavior in response to their environment. They are now genetically unique subset of bears. They're still polar bears, but they are now truly evolving into a different species altogether. This is called rapid evolution. And so the polar bears, this group of them, are actually evolving. They're about 50 to 100 years evolving faster than the rest of the polar bear population. Isn't that fascinating? I know. So to me, I think of polar bears, people, and possibility. If the polar bears can do it, so can the people. And so I think of all this to say the spiritual life, spiritual praxis is participating in our own evolution. Back to Dr. Delio. She says, religion isn't what you believe, it's who you are and how you live on a daily basis. And so when I become ultimately concerned with wholeness making, surprise, the sciences, when you start to integrate as a living system, you integrate both the parts within yourself and with others, that actually is the process of becoming a more complex organism. Mm-hmm. Integration and disintegration. There's a lot of science there, I won't get into it. However, so when you live integratively, both within yourself and among you, you actually speed up and participate in your own evolution. So if we want to close the gap, but we're not going to slow life down, right? We are overwhelmed, chronically overwhelmed and chronically lonely because we don't know how to yet manage the world that we have created for ourselves. And the good news is, just like this subset of polar bears, we are capable of participating in our own rapid evolution. And the beautiful part is that is also spiritual practice.
So the polar bears are giving hope to humanity, basically.
Yes. And interestingly, they're the apex predators, right? So they're actually, I have teenagers, so we ask a lot of trivia questions. But the polar bears are the number one predator in all the world, other than humans. And there's a lot to say about apex predators, but here's what is so fascinating. I went to the Chicago Museum and I saw Sue, the largest Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? And it made me think of apex predators. And the dinosaurs, because you know the reptiles, did not participate in their own evolution and they did become extinct. We, however, as the current apex predators, we actually can choose to participate in our own evolution. We can actually be and become more compassionate as a human species in relationship with the earth and the animals. And we actually, unlike the polar bears and the Tyrannosaurus Rex, we actually get to participate in the salvation of the world mm-hmm. and in the evolution of the world as part of who we are. And I think that sounds like good news.
They do, yeah, for sure. Thank you. Wow. So what does it mean to be human? I'm going back to that question. I mean, I think that's an anchor question we need to... Like, I remember recently I went to a retreat and we started a circle to get to know each other with the question, who are you? When the circle was over, the second question was, who are you? Oh. And then by the third time, we all knew which was the question. And we were like 7-8 times, like for 3 hours, like digging and exploring.
I want to do that.
Who are you? Who are you?
I need to go on whatever retreat you're going on.
So... And this is the same. What does it mean to be human? Okay, first round. Round two, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be human? I want to force, as you say before, to be human means to ask that question, right? I would say that's something that especially defines what does it mean to be human, is that you are constantly asking, what does it mean to be human?
I mean, the polar bears are not asking, what does it mean to be a polar bear?
Exactly. And still they evolve in their own way by force of circumstance. But what
exactly.
About us with the tools we have. And I'm thinking about what you mentioned regarding the age we are living and the challenge of being human in this at the speed we are living and the evolutionary mismatch, as you mentioned. I think you used this word in one of your presentations that we are maxed.
It's a real word. I promise I didn't make it up. Read peer review articles, y'all.
Totally agree. I'm going to another expression you refer, which is we are maxed out by a cognitive overload.
Yes.
So I appreciate that because, again, we are dealing with way beyond data that we are accustomed, again, in our evolutionary unfolding.
No joke. Each one of you listening, you consume more information, more data by your morning coffee than our ancestors did in their entire lifetime.
Imagine that. I like those types of comparisons that you are like really jaw-dropping and realizing that's a lot.
Oh,
I don't think I have evolved to keep the pace of that.
Yes.
Reaching the morning coffee time.
Yes.
And I remember going, speaking about Ilia Delia, she will say, recently read a short book of her called Primacy of Love, beautiful small pocketbook. And there she says, more information can lead to fragmentation, to more fragmentation, unless there is an energy that binds us together.
Preach.
right? More information can lead to more fragment. And we already lived in fragmented times, of course. So the question is not how we get more fragmented. And we already receive lots of information that we can hardly keep up. But how information can lead to fragmentation until and unless there is some glue, so to say, that binds it together, which, of course, in her presentation, she was speaking about love. And I totally agree with that. That's a big part for me of the answer, what does it mean to be human today? Because in one sense, in a globalized world with technology, we are more connected than ever. Paradoxically, at the same time, we are more isolated than ever.
Lonely.
This overwhelming. And we need to integrate. Again, we cannot just deny, no, technology, AI. No, it's already part of the game. Way more than what we think it's part of the game in our own lives. So how to integrate that and how to grow and how to evolve. And I'm thinking, you a few minutes ago, you spoke about not only integration, but disintegration, which I personally wouldn't say that disintegration is necessarily the opposite of integration, but a necessary complement to it. In the process of evolution, you need to disintegrate, you need to deconstruct, you need to die in order to be born again. And I think you said in a podcast I listened, where you were invited, not this lecture I was referring, something like chronic disintegration is when fragmentation occurs.
Yes.
Like implying there's no problem with disintegration. It's necessary process for integration. But chronic disintegration is the actual problem, and which creates this divide, this split, this fragmentation. So it makes me think about, I don't know, Father Richard was speaking about order, disorder, reorder. So we need disorder, we need disintegration, but not to a chronic point, to a chronic degree. That's when fragmentation occurs.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I'm at. Like, I work with so many clients, and I'll have people say, oh, Shalene, I disintegrated. I go, no. You are literally designed that way. You are a living system. You are meant to dance the dance of integration and disintegration on a daily basis. Maybe a way to say that would be, think of the flowers in the field. There are going to be times when the water conditions aren't exactly right. The sun is not shining. Even the lotus flower, right? It goes back underwater at night. That's a form of rest and even disintegration, right? So disintegration is enough stress on a living system that allows the system to reorganize. So a living system is what's called self-organizing. So that means it's constantly reorganizing based on its environmental conditions. Well, you can't reorganize unless there's some type of disorganization, right? So the idea of reorganization is not static. So there, it's to your point, it's a process. So there, in order for something to be in process, there has to be an actual, it can't be static. So you can't stay integrated. So the goal is never to live in a static, integrated state. It is to participate in the dance of integration and disintegration, and then also becoming aware of when you become chronically disintegrated, when you feel like the parts within yourself and between you and others, when they're not coming back into functional harmony with each other, that's when you've hit the point of fragmentation.
What do you say? What will you say, Shalene, if there is such a thing as chronic disintegration reaching to fragmentation? Taken to fragmentation. What about chronic integration?
Chronic integration. I love that. So that's the thing about living systems. There's something called cyclical integration. So the more times a living system goes through the processes of disorganization and reorganization, or disintegration and reintegration, the more often you do that, your neural pathways are actually able to find their way back into reintegration faster and more regularly, which to me is that chronic integration. It doesn't mean you stay there, but cyclical integration means that when you disintegrate, you actually reorganize faster and more often. And to me, that's who the historic Jesus is. There are so many different people who have, I don't want to say successful or achieved, that's not in any way possible, but the idea of like who are living cyclical integration lives. And I think that's what draws humankind. It's what it lets us imagine it. Francis de Troyes, he wrote the Mirror Bible, and he says, Jesus is not an example to you. It's an example of you. the idea that Jesus is an example of humankind living in cyclical integration.
Mm.
And so I think of the historic Jesus. I love Howard Thurman talks about the religion of Jesus, mm-hmm. as opposed to religion about Jesus, subject, mm-hmm. as opposed to object. That's mm-hmm. a whole different sermon. But I believe the religion of Jesus is a religion of integration. And to your point, and to back to Dr. Delio, the idea of more information leads to fragmentation unless there's a glue. And I believe that integration actually is that glue. And integration leads to wholeness making, and it's filled with love. And integration is the thing that allows us to keep reorganizing.
Hmm. Let's go for a moment there to wholeness making. I really love the expression. It sounds very much Ilia Delio-like.
Yes.
Maybe it's your own expression. From whomever is coming, have copyright here. It's all
this belongs to the world. And I say wholeness making because in the English language, we're obsessed with nouns. You know, people, mm-hmm. place, and things, static. Mm-hmm. And so to say wholeness.
Verb, active, making.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So to say wholeness, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, again, myself included, I experience shame and sadness when I don't feel whole. Mm-hmm. Because in my mind, staying whole is the goal when I think of it as a noun, a state of being. That's why I add the wholeness making. It's a verb. Wholeness making is being and become made whole over and over and over again in process.
Ongoing.
Which, by the way, is the Greek word sozo, which translates to salvation. Mm. So it's a verb.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful.
Even the wholeness making isn't a verb, but okay, grammar nerds, don't freak out, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, this word salvation that of course you translate as wholeness making. Thank you for that. I mean, salvation, we have no problem with salvation in itself, but again, what's our understanding of the word? And that can, mm-hmm. frame and affect and traumatize generations and millennia. Just one word without being properly explored. And,
yes. And our biggest problem is we thought salvation was a noun, something, mm-hmm. we could get saved. You know, like I think of in America, we have all these got Jesus or got saved. You know, like the Got Milk campaign.
You don't need even to Christianity. I can give you so many examples from my own tradition and other traditions.
Y'all, this isn't like a product you go pick up at the store.
Yeah.
Like, it's a process. Salvation is a process you participate in from cradle to grave, from morning till night. Even while you sleep, you're participating in the process of salvation as wholeness making.
And I personally like to conceive salvation. I mentioned that in my book. Not the real question is not, and I remember that also 2 years ago, I was in a retreat with Father Richard Rohr, and they asked him, please give a blessing to conclude the meeting. And he spontaneously said, what came first to him is like, please, dear God, please protect us so we stop asking this question when we will get saved. Because, I mean, there's so much time lost in asking that question. Again, I'm not saved yet. And when I'm saved, it's game over. It's like a dead end. Yes. Instead of thinking, in one sense, you're already saved, but also that's an ongoing process that never ends. Again, wholeness.
Yes.
And in my book, I put it in the way, the real question is not only when I will be saved, but even not what I'm being saved from, because that still contains a negative implication of getting out from here or getting out from the situation and need to be safe from. So you are framing the whole conversation negatively. So we are beginning with a no rather with a yes.
Yes. We have somehow bought into the lie that we need to be saved from the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder we hate ourselves and other humans so much.
Yeah. And then in the name of becoming spiritual and holy, we become inhuman. Because we need to be saved from such a thing as being human. So
as being human. Right.
Yeah. My gosh. So I like to reframe it as rather than being saved, when I will be saved, no. What I've been saved from, no. But what I'm being saved for, right? In the sense of, again, salvation is an ongoing process and it's a positive for. Mm. I'm saved for serving, for loving, for dedicating myself in a newer and newer way. So
yes, and I need to be saved every day. Every day my heart cries out to the divine going, help. I need help. Fragmentation is real. And maybe that's why we have so much language around brokenness, right? Like we there is brokenness in the human experience, but humans are not fundamentally broken as the core essence of human nature. And so that's why I've preferred the term fragmentation, because it's a remembering as a reintegrating process that's ongoing.
And the opposite of remembering is not forgetting, but dismembering.
Oh my gosh, Abraham Heschel, you all, I met his daughter at the academic conference, and
that's
I didn't even know.
I sent an email to her trying to invite her to my podcast.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't receive a reply. If you get some personal touch, just...
I hope she listens to this. She's like a brilliant Jewish feminist. And she sat next to me. She introduced herself as Suzanne Heschel. And I was like, I'm sorry. Like, I wanted to ask so badly, like, are you related to Abraham Heschel? But I didn't want to be like awkward. And I'm kicking myself for not asking, because I found out later. I sat next to her the whole 2 hours.
Mm.
And I was like, oh my gosh, how did I miss this connection? She's brilliant in her own right. You all, you need to look her up, look her work up.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
She is one of the most brilliant feminists. The way she speaks about life and religion it's incredible.
Shalene, I'm thinking about you. You used the term neuro-relational integration. We are talking about integration already.
Yes.
We are talking about humanness, adaptation. Mm-hmm. All of this for me is closely tied to the idea of evolution, of course, and to notions like neuroplasticity or things like epigenetics.
Genetics,
well.
Microbiome. There's all kinds of ways we could go right now.
Let's get nerdy and go to that glossary. And you also speak in that concept that we've been exploring that, but let's go to that concept, maladaptive evolution also, no? Like an evolution that is unable to work in a healthy way.
Yes.
So in that concept, you bring the notion of neuro-relational integration. So it's something which moved from this maladaptive evolution into what you refer again as wholeness making.
Yep.
Which you further describe as salvation. So again, there's a lot there.
There's so much there. I'm certainly not arrogant enough to answer the question, what does it mean to be human? But as I explore alongside of you and wrestle with it, at present, to be human for me means to be a neurobiological relational living system. So neurobiological, meaning we all know we have neurology and biology mixed together, and we are innately relational beings. And so that, like, our relationality is actually innate to our neurobiology. There's a lot we can talk about on when it comes to the science of that. And so if I think of what it means to be human, it means to be a neurobiological hyphen relational being. But, you know, neurobiological relational is hard to say. So if you just drop the biological and put a hyphen, neurorelational gets you to the same concept of, so for me, neurorelational summarizes what I am exploring as the human experience right now. That's the essence of humanity, if you will, neurobiological relational. And then integration as the glue. So when I think of, think of it like this. We have, I'm going to get real nerdy, but I'm going to make it very concise. We have three brains, not one.
I was going to ask about that in a few minutes, so please go ahead.
And by brain, I mean a significant conglomeration of neurological activity that functions in a way that has its own memory, its own data collection. It's basically its own way of thinking, but not thinking in conscious terms. Think of let me say it real quick. We have a head brain, which we all know, but we are not just brains walking around on sticks. We have this amazing head brain. And this is why, for me, cognitive science, even right now, neurotheology is overly obsessed with the neurology part, but they're actually missing a lot of the biology part, like the somatic wisdom and intelligence. So we tend to just stick to cognitive neuroscience, which, I mean, I love good cognitive neuroscience study. And also, that's only one data source that human beings have. Our second brain, there's a great book literally called The Second Brain, is your gut brain. So think of, you have 86 billion neurons in your head brain. Think of it like, I correlate it with the mind. So think consciousness in that way.
Won't this be related to what we call sometimes the gut instinct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's exact. So your gut instinct is its own brain. So you have anywhere from 168 to 500 to 600 million neurons in your gut brain and your gut brain axis, which means the basically think of like the highway that goes from your actual guts to your head brain.
And I kind of avoid thinking about the chakras in the Indian tradition.
Yes.
And there are seven, they're not three, but still they begin.
This is true. You should not avoid it.
Yeah.
They're all the way there. And interestingly, from an evolutionary standpoint, your gut brain actually evolved before your head brain. So it's actually your oldest brain, which is a fascinating, that's a whole different thing. So you have 86 billion neurons in your head brain. Think of it a mind. The mind demands a narrative. You have no option but to think in narrative. So I call the mind the storyteller. Then you have your gut brain, depending on which study you're following, 168 to 600 million neurons. And it actually is its own brain. Like this is what we call somatic wisdom or somatic quotient, SQ. This is embodied knowing. This is your gut instincts. You have an autonomic nervous system that every room you walk into, you are using what Stephen Porges called neuroception.
Reading the room, so to say.
Reading the room, yes.
Reading the room through your gut, basically. Through.
Yes, your gut reads its room below the level of consciousness. This is what we call non-conscious. And it is scanning for cues of safety or danger. This is polyvagal theory. It doesn't speak the language of logic, rationality. It doesn't speak story. I think in NRI, neurorelational integration, I call it your survival assessor. It's only asking two questions. Am I safe or am I in danger? Is this a threat? And, I love how polyvagal theory, they talk about it's going to register a saber-toothed tiger the exact same as a marital battle or a really harsh note from your boss in the email. Like, your gut brain doesn't distinguish between a fight with your spouse, a fight with your kid, and conflict with your coworkers.
So now it starts to feel like all the three brains, which still we're missing the third one, act together and support each other, interconnected.
Yes, so I never use I correlate the second brain. I just say body. Obviously, I'm going back and forth between measurable neuroscience, like here's your actual neurons, and then metaphor, helping you. The mind need the brain, the storyteller needs categories. And so think of your head brain like the mind, your gut brain, think body, somatic wisdom, embodied knowing. Then your third brain, this is the most exciting, and I've really, really nerd out on this. You have a heart brain. You have 40,000 neurons around your heart, and your heart, your actual heart, it's your cardiac nervous system. It has its own memory, its own way of relating. I call it your relational attuner.
Well, you connect that somehow with the concept of emotional intelligence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So think of it like this. All emotions are social. So emotional intelligence is a subset of social intelligence. So think social, emotional. And then with the latest neuroscience, we also now can convincingly say that your spirituality is innate to your neurobiology. So your spirituality is as natural to the human being as emotions are. It's actually part of your neurobiology. So I think of the heart brain like social-emotional-spiritual intelligence. This is your relational attuner. This is the part of you that is innately relational. So I correlate that with spirit because we think about mind, body, spirit. I correlate mind, body, spirit with each of the three brains within us and between us. And each of these are its own source of neural intelligence. Each one, your heart brain and your gut brain, are both scanning the room. And in fact, your heart brain can create an electromagnetic field that is stronger than any of the other two brains, and it extends outside of your body up to 3 to 6, maybe 15 feet. So now I want you to correlate that with the kingdom of heaven is near, here, now. And so when we talk about heaven on earth, we're actually talking about the way that we create electromagnetic fields, like true relational fields that are communicating, like my heart brain is communicating to your heart brain. My gut brain is communicating to your gut brain. And then our head brains just happen to be having a conversation with language. So all these are happening at the same time.
Yeah, and all that makes me think how much we have impact on one another way beyond what we can measure at any given moment. We are exerting influence on the environment to such a degree and being influenced in turn. And I'm thinking again, and I remember you mentioned about this, not only about these three brains, but how the three brains are interconnected all the time.
All the time.
And in that context, you say something that I really loved. You say, like, therefore, regulating our nervous system is an act of worship.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. I appreciate it.
Could you imagine if more people regulated their nervous system multiple times a day as prayer, as worship? Like, okay, you think of, I just think of, like, you want to talk about good news for all humankind? I'm going to go with regulated human beings.
Let's start there.
I'm going to go with human beings who are evolving on a daily basis. That sounds like truly good news for all creation.
And I think also speaking in these terms, speaking of neurobiology and the brains, that got all, it helps us to gain more somatic awareness, if you want to call it that way, and make our spirituality more embodied and related to authentic transformation. Because as you may have had your own experience, me, mine, many of us may have come from a notion of spirituality which was pretty disembodied.
Oh, yes.
Not only body, negating the body or negating things going on related to the body, but even in the notion of otherworldly future eternal attainment and the here and now doesn't count. So it's a way of disembodying the present moment.
Yes.
So I can see how important it is to ground all this.
Ground it.
So this
you
language,
know, it's funny.
Articulating
well, it's so funny you say that. So I'm around a lot of academics, even though I'm like the least likely academic in the room. It's so interesting. I was just at the AAR, which is the American Academy for Religion, and all, like, you know, the world's smartest religious people get together and then have a contest of who's the smartest. I cannot compete at that level, so I just play a different game. And what was so interesting is, as a neurotheologian, which is very, you know, it's a very rare thing in the sense that it's a very new field, and anyone entering it is coming through the lab of, like, neuroscience. I'm coming from as a theologian. And they all talk about, you know, a super heady abstract theology. And then I go, well, you know, I talk about regulating our nervous system as spiritual praxis or as worship. And the very first question every single academic asked is, aren't you afraid of reductionism? Reducing the divine to your neurobiology? And I kind of sit with that and, you know, and then I say, aren't you afraid of missing the divine? Because the only chance you have of experiencing the divine is in your neurobiology.
So that takes me to this question that it's actually similar to what these people may have asked you, like, how do we honor neurobiology without reducing the sacred to mere brain activity, so to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is where we all get to evolve into quantum, right? You all know quantum thinking. So classic thinking, right? Or classic computers are zeros and ones. It's a zero, it's a one. It's a zero, it's a one. I think of Microsoft did a great 10-minute video on this. You all can look it up. Think of a light switch. It's on or it's off. That question is a very classic binary question. It's on or it's off. Well, quantum thinking is zeros and ones at the same time. So when you move into quantum thinking and you apply that to both your spirituality and your neurobiology, of course it's not reductionist, because you're experiencing the divine within and beyond your body at the same time. But most importantly, you have no option but to experience the divine through your neurobiology and in your neural networks. So to be so afraid of reducing the divine is actually to miss the divine, because you're so busy looking for it outside that you're actually missing salvation as wholeness making that is currently happening inside.
And the very fear that you feel, how to say, gets in the way of you perceiving God already there, so to say.
Yes. They're so afraid of reducing it that they're just missing the experience of it.
Yeah, they are so afraid of reducing it that they reduce it by being afraid of reducing it.
Brilliant. Yes. Yes. And I go, come on, zeros and ones at the same time. This is both. Mm-hmm. Back to that Aramaic, ba, within and among. The divine is within your neurobiology and among the neurobiology of you and those around you and in the trees and the earth, like within and among.
I'm thinking
simultaneously.
I'm thinking about the official name in Sanskrit of our metaphysical system in my tradition is called Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, which means reality is simultaneously and inconceivably one and different.
Yes.
Or, so it's basically saying the same thing. It's not one or different. It's both and it's beyond our paradoxical. It's beyond the usual mm-hmm. way in which we think about things. So we are invited to develop a new way, again, imagination, trying to think from another place.
And here's the vision I want to cast. When you wake up in the morning and you step in dog poop, your alarm doesn't go off, your kid isn't getting off to school in the right time, maybe you're in a fight with a partner, coworker, sibling, pausing, taking deep breaths, participating in any activity that is going to access and activate your vagus nerve, that is spiritual worship within those 30 seconds to 3 minutes. So when you hold your child and you co-regulate your child, that's holy work. That's sacred work, whatever religion you are, or beyond religion.
Makes me think of Brother Lawrence's book, The Practice of the Presence.
Yes. Right?
In those micro moments of the day, you can create, you can invoke the church, the altar, the holy.
So funny you say that. Practicing the presence of God, Brother Lawrence. I read that when I was on Young Life staff as an early 22-year-old, newly graduated, my first round of seminary. And I was like, well, of course you can see God in everything. You're a monk in the, 15th century or whatever. All you do is peel potatoes. And then I realized, oh, but when I take deep breaths while driving, that is practicing the presence. Yeah. That is holy. Yeah. That's spiritual worship. Yeah.
Peeling potatoes is just a template to whatever, to anything.
Yes, and I didn't get it because I was so busy locating the spirituality outside of myself. Mm-hmm. I had to go get God, right? I had to do my daily devotions, wake up before the sun.
We have to begin somewhere. We have to begin somewhere.
Yep. Right?
Not to be resentful about those chapters, but just, okay, it's kindergarten. You have to go through kindergarten and compartmentalize and thinking do's and don'ts. I have a more dualistic thinking. Okay.
And I was so busy going out and getting God externally that I was missing the divine internally. I was missing my deep rest as regulation.
It makes me think of a quote from Ilya Delio that I share in my book, something like, instead of standing in the world and looking for God, we should stand in God and look at the world, right?
Yes. It's funny, I talk with her. This is what I'm hoping our friends that are listening. Ilya Delio is maybe one of the most brilliant minds, as you hear us fangirling over her. Really interestingly, when we think of both her work and Teilhard and Christogenesis, which is the evolution towards greater complexity as spiritual praxis, evolution as becoming, her work is so brilliant and also so abstract, right? Like you read it and it's like the evolution of the cosmos, and it is so beautiful. And I think that's where I hope she thinks of this in the same way. But I think of it like one of my kids runs track, like passing the baton. And my hope is that she casts this vision for Christogenesis and evolutionary becoming, but it's so abstract and so deeply prophetic and imaginative that it's just truly not practical. Like when I talk to her, she goes, oh yeah, my work's not practical at all. I go, no.
But again, going back to imagination, right? Someone has to be thinking and imagining, implementing we may talk about in a few generations.
Yes. I'm like, you gave me this beautiful vision. And then I'm like, yeah, but I'm screaming at my husband right now. Your Christogenesis and cosmic theology is not all that helpful in this moment. But you know what is helpful? Neuro-relational integration. Regulating my nervous system as spiritual praxis, bringing my gut brain into functional harmony with the stories of my mind and the relational attunement of my heart. That made practical on a daily basis. As evolution, okay, I can do that. I like to contemplate the cosmos, but if I could just, get into some heart coherence here, that would be great.
Start with your microcosmos over there at home, and then we go to the macro one. Yeah.
Yes.
And Shalene, speak about neurobiology, and you were talking about our minds and what happens in our microcosmos. Something that also, an important theme that I've heard you touching is, in your own words, the neurobiology of shame. So I don't know if we can go there for a minute because
damaging.
It's an important one. I'm currently finishing writing my next book, my fourth book, which will be revolving around the principle of unconditional love. And in the context of trying to understand what's unconditional love, how to receive it, how to embrace it, how to extend it, and so on. Also, what gets in the way of the experience of it. And of course, in the context of exploring what gets in the way, I will go to the classical questions and theodicy. And I'm very grateful to Thomas J. Ord for his contribution in this regard. But yeah. also to toxic ideas about the divine and how that may yeah. in turn create a toxic sense of how we see ourselves in connection to the divine, to others, to a toxic sense of shame and guilt that prevents us from a genuine experience mm-hmm. of God's unconditional love. And you say something, I like to quote that directly, have it written with me. You say in this connection, an authoritarian God primes your brain for violence and physiologically, on neuroscientific levels, reduces your capacity for empathy and compassionate mm-hmm. action.
Preach. I would love to take that. That's actual just straight neuroscience. So truly, and this is why I see neuroscience as theology, because it is. And there is incredible amount of research on, to your point, let's just take shame. We can now definitively say how incredibly harmful shame is to us on cellular to relational to societal levels. And shame is different than guilt, you all. So I'm sure most of you know this, but you know, I appreciate Brené Brown's work on this, that guilt says I did something bad and shame says I am bad. Yeah. So your identity statements really, this is where cognitive neuroscience is very helpful. One of my favorite books, Energy Rising, Julie DeGangey is one of my also favorite neuroscientists. She does an incredible, just as a neuroscience, it's also the most theologically beautiful book I've read, because she talks about your felt sense of power is directly connected to your felt sense of value, which is directly connected to your felt sense of wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to wholeness making as the foundational essence of humankind. And shame actually is what fragments you. You become chronically disintegrated, fragmented from your wholeness. And that is deeply harmful and incredibly damaging.
You give a very terrifying number. You say the frequency of shame is 1 hertz above death.
1 hertz above death.
Please
now listen, this is technical
for the audience, so they become even more terrified in the good sense, not shameful.
In a good sense. This is true.
They know how to
deal
with
this. This is still technically considered pseudoscience, but most good science is pseudoscience. But we now are putting we're putting hertz levels to emotions. You can look this up, go online. I'm not making this up. And we're starting to recognize that emotions have, like we talked about earlier, electromagnetic energy. So think of it like this: every emotion you feel. Emotions are both molecules and they're also electromagnetic energy that's going through your body. So with every beat of your heart, whatever emotion you're feeling is getting that hertz level, that energy, electromagnetic energy is getting broadcasted into the room, creating a relational field around you. Okay. So you're not the only one feeling that emotion. The people next to you are their heart brains are also feeling it. So you think about shame, but they did this incredible hertz level. They call them lower energizing emotions and higher energizing emotions. You can look this up. So you have death as like obviously the lowest non-hertz level, but one tick above death is shame. And then it goes up guilt, anger. And guilt and anger, all of these can be very helpful. Emotions are not good, bad, right, or wrong. They're just, they're signals, right? Helping you understand what's going on. But when you get a signal of anger, you can go, okay, what's going on in my environment? And it can help move you into action, right? Shame, because it's an identity statement, it's an identity emotion, it functions differently. Is it actually drives you deeper into the spiral. I call it the spiral of death because that's where it leads. Like shame ultimately leads to death. And that's not good news for anyone. And shame is an identity statement. This is why as a theologian, this is how it connects to authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is an ideology, be it religious, political, relational, it doesn't matter, that is centralizing power and where the power dynamics functions hierarchically. So think top down. So authoritarianism profits from fragmentation, benefits from fragmentation, specifically shame. And so you think of from my religious perspective, how incredibly brilliant it is to start to convince humans that they are fundamentally bad, that they are now spiritually disconnected from their power, from their felt sense of value and wholeness.
Inherent to the evil, fallen from paradise, there is some intrinsic constitutional fault with who you are.
Exactly.
The core of your being. Yeah.
Exactly. We have so many, you know, from my tradition within Christianity, we have so many doctrines that are authoritarian doctrines that actually function to fragment because the imperialistic system benefits from said fragmentation.
Like what, and, yeah, going back to Walter Brueggemann and the royal consciousness versus the prophetic one. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly. I mean, within my tradition, you know, the teachings of Jesus married imperialistic power in the 3rd and 4th century and just never got divorced. So part of my hope is to help facilitate said divorce from a few doctrines, right, that are shame-based doctrines. Locating our identity in the emotion of shame is fragmenting, cellularly harmful, and relationally harmful. Like, these have actual true impact on our bodies. So authoritarianism and shame shorten your telomeres. Those are, read Gabor Mate. He'll talk to you about patriarchy, which is one of my favorite subjects. But any system of dominance, which is what authoritarian systems are, you have these tiny called telomeres on the end of your cells, which is your biological life. And when you're in a system of dominance, authoritarian system, shame-based doctrines, they actually shorten your chronological life. They shorten your telomeres and create all kinds of autoimmune disease.
Yeah, no wonder it's so close to death there. Some of them may literally take you to want to take your life, but some others may reduce your lifespan, which is another way of speaking about it, shame killing you, literally.
Right.
In so many ways. Right. Yeah.
So that's why, like, when wholeness making, when salvation is rooted in wholeness making, it is also innately healing. Mm-hmm. And it's like healing on cellular levels, not just relational and spiritual levels. It's, oh my gosh, I can actually participate in healing my gut through wholeness making. I can actually start to heal deep levels of trauma and autoimmune diseases. And I'm not saying, like, let me be really careful. There's a lot of things. Healing and a cure are two very different things. This is where I really appreciate disability theology. We can experience healing without experiencing a cure from our physical ailments. And that's what salvationist wholeness making is about. Sometimes it can be a cure, but we can still experience healing while dying.
Yeah. So as shame can be all pervading healing, we need to find a corresponding level of all pervadingness in healing. And I was thinking about going to the Christian tradition for a moment, not only to the Christian tradition, of course, but I'm thinking about this terminology regarding, again, inherently sinful, like the original sin doctrine versus original blessing. Again, you are loved unconditionally from day zero. And also the very word sin, how it was presented in such a way, while the original basically meant missing the mark, right?
Yeah.
Which, okay, you miss the mark, life happens,
what's the mark?
Try again, shoot again, right? We are practicing archery all together. And then you refer to this other term in connection to sin, because if you do sin or you are sinful, then you need to atone, right? To atonement versus at
one-ment. Yes.
What do you refer by that, if you could briefly elaborate? Just to give a few examples of how, with language, we can heal, or we can do exactly the opposite.
We can split apart. It's funny. It's the same thing. It's the same words, very different meanings, right? So on the one side, when you have sin being, when the target is perfection and you miss the mark of perfection, man, that creates a very different ideology. When the goal is to be statically perfect, that means your goal is to be dead. Like you're no longer living. If you're statically perfect, you are no longer alive.
An eternal dead end, basically.
Eternal dead end, which is why we become so fixated on our afterlife. When your target is a static state of perfection, to use Brian McLaren's words, which I really appreciate, your goal is to actually be dead. You're no longer living.
Sounds like hell, basically.
Literally, exactly. And it does create hell. We've seen that happen now for centuries. And then it changes your definitions of all the other words, right? So then you need at one or atonement, which is punishment. Like, oh my gosh. But when you think of sin, when the mark is wholeness making, I miss the mark of wholeness making every single day, whether it's internal dialogue, habits that I have that are just hurtful to me, the way I interact with others. I sin every day. So if you need to call me a sinner, I'm here for it. But it helps me to go, oh, I want to help bring myself back into alignment with wholeness making.
Yeah, you can always fall upward in the words of Father Richard Rohr, right?
That's exactly right. Where that's what creates, back to our living systems, the rupture repair cycle. When your target is wholeness making, that's what creates the rupture repair cycles. That's what creates the cycles and the dance of integration and disintegration, organization, reorganization. And it is a beautiful process. It is innate to the human experience. And we are actually saved in the human experience, not from it. And so when you're ultimately concerned, when the target is wholeness making and you miss the mark of wholeness making and then come back into alignment and start functioning in harmony again through integrative processes and living, you experience at-one-ment. And that those are rare moments, you all. Andrew Newberg, who's my favorite neurotheologian, he's a neuroscientist. He talks about Wired for Enlightenment. It's a great book. You should get it. And he talks about little E enlightenment and big E enlightenment. And I think of the big E enlightenment like the at one ment, those indescribable transcendent moments of cosmic unity, the thing that you don't get all the time, but when it comes around, you're like, this is, it gives you that fuel to keep going again. Here's put it in movie terms, okay? If you're a movie watcher, did you see the most recent Brad Pitt movie, F1?
No.
Okay, well, listen. Brad Pitt, he's a
I haven't, I have watched the one that he visits the Buddha, that's like from 25 years ago.
Well, yes,
I think I'm a little bit out of date, yeah. Tibet or something.
Yeah. I'm always looking for how do I make, these religious terms or neuroscientific terms practical? So here's your practical application with Brad Pitt. In the F1 movie, he's this washed up Formula One race car driver. And there's, by the way, I'm about to ruin the movie for you, anyone. So skip this part if you don't want me to ruin it. He keeps going, he'll get hired and he keeps saying, it's not about the money. People will hire him to do different things. And then he'll say, it's not about the money. And they'll say, what's it about? And he won't quite answer, So the whole movie goes well, if it's not about the money, what's it about? Towards the end of the movie, he says, he finally describes the what's it about. He goes, that moment when all of the pain and the problems of the world fall away and you're just in perfect flow. You have become one with the car and the earth and the wind. And that shows this moment of him in the car. He goes, I've been chasing that moment my whole life. And that was this beautiful, Hollywood blockbuster Brad Pitt example of at one ment or big E enlightenment, those moments, those transcendent moments that are rare that we end up chasing our whole life.
Yeah. But that when they happen, they are so undeniably evident that even if you don't feel them for the rest of your life, still the rest of your life can hold on them and, so to say, develop healthy faith based on those moments that are, I like to say, too real to deny, but also too vast to comprehend or to even explain. So it puts you in this paradoxical situation of this is impossible to deny, but it's a mystery.
It's a mystery. Yes. And I love that the science, the neurobiology of it, Andrew Newberg, he says this, that little E enlightenment moments prime your brain and wire your brain for those big E moments, those at one ment. And so it's not, you're not just out of luck. There is something you can participate and practice. When you practice little E enlightenment, when you practice embodiment and integration, it does actually prime your neurobiology for those big E moments, those at-one-ment experiences. And that makes me feel so hopeful, right? There's something I can participate in.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes me think about the daily spiritual practices that different traditions may have, like a more disciplined, quote-unquote, forced way of, okay, now at this time I'm entering sacred time, sacred space, little enlightened moments. So eventually, hopefully, as a proper result of that, you realize every time is sacred, every space is sacred, and the enlightenment starts to, the E in the enlightenment gets bigger and bigger, so to say.
Yes.
And I'm thinking the Christian tradition, of course, if there is one, of course, there are more than one, but if there is one example of that is Jesus, and he represents the embodiment of a lot of things, of course. And mm-hmm. I'd like to go for a moment again back to the principle of unconditional love, and as he himself says, not like someone for us not merely to worship or believe in, but to follow. And like Father Richard will say, Jesus never said, worship me. He always say, follow me, which of course is way more difficult. It's easy to worship anyone, put someone on the altar, put a garland, offer incense, mm-hmm. and to embody that. You say something before that I really appreciate. You say, Jesus is not an example to us, but an example of us. So that's,
mm-hmm.
I cannot avoid thinking about how in our tradition we will think of the word guru, mm-hmm. like a guru is not ideally someone who is authoritarian telling you what to do, but is, in the words of one of my teachers, he said, a guru is your own potential appearing in front of you.
Yes.
No? So it's someone who embodies all that you can be and is lovingly willing to assist you in excavating your own potential.
Yes.
So it makes me think similarly to what you say, Jesus is not an example to me, but an example of me, of all that I can be in potential. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a portal of potential, so to say, and going back to imagination, close to those personalities, our imagination about who we can be, because we have sometimes very like suffocating ideas and very narrow who I am.
Yes.
What's all that I can be? Sometimes we need the imagination to get triggered by the life and teachings of people like them. So
yes.
I don't know if you have any thoughts in this connection.
Well, that also, the at-one-ment too is also like ecstasy of St. Teresa, right? Mm-hmm. Go to Italy and you can see that. Like there many people have experienced this. And when you look, that's back to Howard Thurman, right? The religion of Jesus and not about. One is subject, that when you look at Jesus as a subject of study, when integration, the religion of Jesus is a religion of integration. And when it becomes who you are and what you do on a daily basis, it actually grows and evolves you and becomes good news for all creation. And it's inherently threatening to authoritarian systems. So there is a cost to this wholeness making thing, friends. Like, do not think for a second that participating in and being ultimately concerned with wholeness making is going to end up with, you know, roses, wine, and sunshine.
Oh, it's the highest thing which demands the highest price, probably.
Absolutely. Like, I find myself at odds now with so many different relationships and systems that I used to be quite cozy with. I got to be honest, like when I was, a lot of the times I couldn't quite understand what those early Christians were dying for. You're dying for ideas about God. And I realized I like God, but I don't know if dying for ideas about God is, you know, where I'm at. When
teacher,
I Rob, now live.
Sorry to interrupt. Teacher of mine will say, your ideas should be such that it's worth living, but also worth dying for.
Seriously. And now I go, now this way of living, I mean, to be honest, I can't not live this way any longer. Like, because I have now experienced salvation as wholeness making, the idiom, once you see, you can't unsee, right? Like I can't unsee this way of being human any longer. And
and you cannot force those who haven't seen it yet to be there. But you
that's
cannot
exactly
force yourself
right.
to go back there, so it's either.
It now, like, this is exactly right. Like, where you start, and I don't mean evolved in the sense of I am better than the other human. I'm saying I'm a different version of myself. Like, I can't go back. Like, this is, you know, talking about a new creation. It's because you can't go back to the old brain structure.
And that shows also the willingness of every person to participate in relationship, because even if you're in that new version of yourself and I'm somewhere else, I could be willing to catch up and you to catch up with me. And that's ideally what a relationship is about. But not everyone is willing to pay that price again.
No, it's a high price to pay. I mean,
because you have to die. You have to die to a version of yourself to to accompany the new version of the other person as well. In this daily, this accompanying yes. relationship, it's ongoing.
Yes, it comes at a cost, and it's not super lucrative. In case anyone's wondering, like, I got news. It is not one of the things that is going to lie. Now I understand all those verses about money. I was like, oh man, yeah, no, this is not lucrative at all. In fact, it goes against all the systems that are profiting from fragmentation. You have now made yourself an enemy of the state.
It's a very counterintuitive notion to the empire consciousness that we may still carry to some degree. So therefore, it's
yes.
terrifying for many. And that's why we need enough reasons, positive enough reasons, not to be actually terrified, but hopefully to pursue it for the right reasons, not out of guilt, not out of shame, not out of pressure.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it does. It literally does change you. Like, it changes you on neurobiological levels. But to your point, so you can also change maladaptively. Like, all of you are evolving. Some of you are participating in it. Some are not. I got in not a fight. That would be the wrong word. But you had mentioned earlier about multidiscipline. This is my ADD brain going back to the beginning of the conversation.
Beautiful.
Full circle. It has been very challenging to talk neuroscience to theologians, and even to talk theology to neuroscientists. There's like a, why are you talking about theology when I just want to talk about cognitive neuroscience? Mm-hmm. And you know, I have one friend say, you know, yeah, your work is like whatever the neuron is. And I was like, oh gosh, okay. And so, but to that point is when we think about like, how do we come back together? How do we integrate? How do we change our brain structures as part of our spiritual practice? When you start to break down the barriers between fields of study, people, relationships, and you start to see all things in relation to other things, you get a more expansive view of reality. And then you start, like living system science, you can't unsee that web once you start to see it. It just becomes the way that your brain, you start just thinking and living in multidisciplinary integrative ways of life where everything starts connecting for you.
And I'm thinking in connection to that, and going back to Jesus for a moment, in terms of evolutionary terms, in terms of neuroplasticity, things like that, that's a way to understand Jesus' words to his followers, like, you will do better things than I even, right?
Yes.
Like wholeness, absolutely. Making, like, further integration. And
yes. You will actually become a new type of human, like a new type of polar bear, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. those polar bears are genetically different. So Jesus is literally saying, you're going to signal different epigenetics than what I am. Right? Isn't that so cool? Like, your genes will actually signal differently. You will have new capabilities. Like, let's take the telepathy tapes. You know, finding out that kids who are nonverbal with autism are telepathic. I'm going to go with pretty freaking awesome there. Like, the way that we can access and do different things. Like, to me, those kids are a more evolved version of humankind. And I am really working on my telepathy now, I'll have you know. I'm fully convinced that I can do this. And I'm going to start really, I've had one telepathic experience. And now I'm like, this is amazing. I'm gonna try to cultivate this.
Okay, we'll be in conversation at the distance.
Yeah, I'll let you know. I might be 90 and still working on it.
No problem. I will be polishing my antenna meanwhile.
Yes.
Shelling, as we wrap up, I don't want to take excessively your precious time, but we are talking about Jesus. We are talking about irreversible grace and shame and neurobiology. But specifically, since we were talking a few minutes ago about shame and what gets in the way, trying to conclude on a positive note in terms of the redemption of shame through integration, we could call it unconditional love. I like to also use the term irreversible grace. Again, once you see it, you cannot unsee it. Like, we speak about irreversible damage, and I said, no, there's no actually irreversible damage, but there is irreversible grace. There's one line from something you said also regarding grace that I really appreciate your definition of it. You say grace is not unmerited favor, like many times it may be officially defined, but grace is when someone sees you for what you truly are and calls you back to your true self. Again, so I connect that to, you say that, right? You can be amazed at that, no problem. There's humility in that. And I related that to the guru. Again, guru is your own potential appearing in front of you. But the real guru or teacher is someone who not only embodies your potential, but sees your potential and sees you for who you truly are. That for me will be, we are units of becoming, units of potential. So I don't know if you would like to ruminate on that a little bit, on actual healthy definition of grace, because as shame is toxic, grace could be toxic if it's not properly defined.
All of these words can go many different ways. The idea of grace as unmerited favor leads to prosperity gospel. It leads to authoritarianism, imperialism, pick your whatever. When I was deep into the polyvagal theory, one of the things that was so helpful to me is the Deb Dana, who's a therapist. She says, the question isn't what's wrong with this person. It's what state are they in? She's specifically talking about the polyvagal theory. Are they in a sympathetic activated state? Are they in fight, flight, fawn mode, collapse mode, ventral vagal? So when I apply that to me, became my working definition of grace, but expanded to include more than just the autonomic ladder. And here's a great way to say this, a story last night, actually. I have a teenager who plays competitive basketball. And he's, you know, senior year, hopefully wants to play in college. He had a game last night. He and his teammate got in a fight on the court. His, you know, the play didn't go. He called the play. The teammate cursed him out, called him selfish. He's comes home. Even though they won the game, he comes home. He's eating dinner at 9, and he's just in an activated state. If you know the window of tolerance, he's outside his window of tolerance. He's in fight mode. He's so upset about this guy. His teammate and my husband, Sam, my partner, was trying to talk to him about, well, hey, you know, part of being a leader is having hard conversations. Can you go back to this? Can you go back to your friend? Can you talk through this conflict? And he's like, no, you know, F him. He's just so upset. And grace in that moment, that definition of grace helped me go. I put my hand on my partner. I go, hey, Sam, he can't hear what you're saying right now. When you are this activated, he truly loses neural circuitry to the area of his brain that is the place of compassion. To your point earlier, when you are in an activated state, you physiologically lose your capacity for compassion. And that is where my son was. And so my husband and I were able to go, oh, this is an unmerited favor. We were able to say, oh, hey, son, let's have some dinner, take some breaths, re-regulate our nervous system, and we'll circle back to this conversation with your friend in the morning when you're more able to hear what we're saying, / when you can re-access your compassion circuitry. So we take some deep breaths, and then I'm going to bed about 11 or midnight, and I hear him, which is too late for a kid, by the way, just so you all know, it was a late night, but I hear him on the phone with his friend talking through it. And I like secretly standing outside the door, you know, like any good eavesdropping mom would. And I was like, oh, way to go, buddy. Like, we didn't shame him. What's wrong with you, kid? You're fundamentally broken and wrong. Da 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 da. It was, oh, you've temporarily lost your neurobiological relational capacity for compassion.
And we missed the
mark. I'm gonna hold you
for a moment.
Yeah. You've missing the mark of wholeness making for yourself. Our kitchen is now activated. Your relational field is not super great. It's not very harmonious. And so it was just, to me, that is a life and a spirituality of integration, that just regulating, standing next to my son and doing deep breaths, even though he didn't know, that was my act of worship last night, holding space for his dysregulated body and his misattuned heart and his angry stories of his friend. All three of his brains were fragmented in that moment, or disintegrated, you could say, and calling him back into integration, but not demanding it. That's a totally different way of parenting for me.
The word spaciousness comes to my mind, like in the sense of allowing the space for all these things to happen and to unfold and to reintegrate eventually. But again, you need to hold the space. And
yeah, you hold space while people disintegrate and dysregulate and act out in, like, we see that Jesus on the cross, forgive them. They know not what they do. They are literally having collective amygdala hijack. This is mob mentality. They truly physiologically, I'm not justifying the murder of Jesus, but I am saying they, from a neurobiological state, they lost their compassion, their ability to access compassion and to see Jesus as a human. Hence the violence that we perpetuate when we dehumanize people.
He held this space inside of
He held grace, right? Like, it wasn't unmerited favor for the mob. Mm-hmm. It was, he recognized what state they're in. Like, oh, this is an amygdala hijack.
There are so many more places and avenues to explore with you. I'm sure we will have more opportunities in the future. I pray for that, dear Shalene.
But yes.
I'm thinking, as a way of closing, if you allow me to do some online social experiment with you. Hopefully you trust me by this point.
I do.
I do it a lot in my podcast. So in this case, I'd love to end with a small contemplative exercise, and I'll offer you 10 single words. And for each one, I don't know, I invite you to share a short phrase, whatever, what that word stirs, reveals, or awakens in you at this precise moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Okay. So first word will be attunement.
Oh, I feel that immediately right in my heart, like TV antennas hoping to tune into the relational fields of others.
Second word will be suffering.
Oh, I feel that more at the base of my spine, like to back to chakras, just I read this one book and in a Native American language, and it talked about sadness, and it said, my heart is on the floor, and that's what I feel in that word.
Third one will be love.
I feel it very expansive. Interestingly, like around my shoulder blades, like my arms feel like they immediately want to go out in a non-closed embrace, but an open embrace.
Then for word will be listening.
You know, I actually feel that in my third eye, the right between, like at first I was thinking my ears, but I think listening is a way of seeing patterns that you maybe didn't see before or that were invisible to you before, like that question you ask on your main website.
Beautiful. Thank you. Next word, vulnerability.
Oh, yeah, that's not my favorite word. I lead with an Enneagram 8. You know, I feel...
You can read it.
It's very different.
Feel free to do that if you want.
Yeah, it's very different. It's easy to be transparent. Vulnerability for me is a willingness to ask for help and depend on another. To make myself vulnerable to other is to acknowledge my actual dependence on others.
Sixth word will be belonging.
I feel that back in my heart space again. And I feel that belonging is an experience. It's something that it's an emergent property that arises from integration. It's not something you can achieve or grab onto or it's something you have to cultivate. You cultivate integration, and I see belonging as something that emerges out of that.
Seventh word will be presence.
I feel that in my feet. I'm standing on a grounding mat right now, and so I immediately feel a deep connection to the earth with that word.
Number eight will be God.
I feel almost that crown chakra immediately of that I'm a dancer. And so when I do ballroom dancing, there is this thing, the posture of like your spine, when you just get pulled upward, it also expands outward and allows you to be like to move in more dynamic ways. And so I hear that word in that way.
The ninth word will be uncertainty.
I feel fear immediately. That activates my amygdala. I feel fear. Uncertainty for me creates a lot of fear, and I have to intentionally step into that, step into the mystery, and intentionally reframe uncertainty as mystery. There's something about I can lean into mystery, but I feel afraid of uncertainty, even though they're basically the same thing.
Okay, and let's conclude with a more grounding one, hopefully, the word home.
I feel that back in my gut brain, just... at home in this body that is me, that carries me.
Welcome back. Thank you so much. You did great. And as we close, Shalene, if there is any simple insight or invitation you'd like to place in the hands of our listeners, something to walk with as they continue their journey.
The real simple, integrate to navigate. You are designed for wholeness making. Your true essence is the essence of wholeness making. And it is an experience, and you experience it through the process of integration. So integrate to navigate life, my friends. And there's no such thing as being an expert human. So expect to fail daily.
Important footnote. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Helen, for your time, for your presence, for the gifts to the world. And I'm delighted and blessed to have you here in the conversation.
Likewise, I can't wait to see you at Ortline. Friends, oh, make sure you give them the Ortline information. And then, yeah, you can find me on nrintegration.com. I'd love to hear from you all. I just signed a book deal with Orbis, so I have sacred stories coming out through weaving together mythology, neurobiology, and practical living today. So that book will be coming out. You can look for that. And yeah, get on my email list. I would love to connect with you, like truly connect and be friends.
Thanks so much.